Thanks a lot for allowing me to have this this impromptu talk. So this topic is, so actually what I'm going to be talking about in this talk, it's sort of like, it's basically my journey to understand the construction of mutually unbiased bases for qubits. So there's like a standard construction which works for prime power dimensions. And when the prime is odd, then the construction is very nice and simple. But when it's even, when it's two, then it's somehow complicated. And, you know, and I was just trying to understand this construction basically. And so this talk is sort of like about that. But, you know, in the process of trying to understand it, I somehow stumbled upon this notion of entropy modulo P. I basically rediscovered it myself. And then I remembered I saw it a blog post by Tom Leinster, I think, and this N category cafe. And then I put the two things together and then sort of like, yeah, so basically in this talk, it's really kind of a journey of how all these things connect. So I think it's maybe appropriate to start with this slide. So basically, you know, that's what the talk is about, entropy modulo P and quantum information. And it's about the connection between the two concepts. So there is a connection. And, you know, as you can see, the connection is maybe not entirely straightforward. So there will be sort of a, yeah, so it's kind of like a long journey, and there will be three characters we will encounter along the way. So there's something called weak vectors, something called Galois rings, and something called mutually unbiased bases. And so these weak vectors, they are sitting kind of close to this entropy modulo P. They are very closely related. And mutually unbiased bases, of course, is something that is a very important in quantum information theory. And so anyway, we'll see how all these things connect together. And actually, I realize I think the talk is actually sort of technical. So if you really like sort of finite fields and rings, then you will be really pleased. But if you don't like them, it may be a little bit overwhelming. But I mean, I think also even if you, I mean, this entropy modulo P is kind of exotic concept. So at least maybe one thing you can take away is there will be these other interesting, you know, abstract algebra things you can maybe learn, and maybe you can use them for something. Okay, so let's start with entropy. So we'll, you know, so I want to kind of have, this talk is kind of also about different guises of entropy. Okay, so what is entropy? You know, okay, like the simple answer is just this formula. It's like sort of shut up and calculate. You just, you know, plug in the probability. That's the answer. But it has, you know, of course, also in information theory, it has the operational meaning. So we have the Shannon source coding theorem. So it's basically, it's the optimal rate of compressing a random variable that has distribution P. And you kind of given many samples, and you know at what rate you can compress, and there is like a you know, clear interpretation of this number and this entropy. But it has also other many other different interpretations. And for example, so there is a nice survey by Botero, which discusses this in detail. So for example, if you have a partition of n, so you just, you know, split the numbers from 1 to n into chunks, so then the multinomial coefficient is proportional. So when n is very large, it's proportional to e to the n times entropy of, you know, take this partition lambda 1 to lambda n, which are integers, and then you normalize to get the probability distribution. And so that's sort of, you know, like basically this multinomial coefficient for large n, it's kind of like the entropy. And it's also asymptotically, it's proportional to the dimension of the symmetric group representation. And, you know, this multinomial coefficient and the symmetric group representation dimension, these are purely combinatorial quantities, but, you know, asymptotically, the entropy somehow relates to this. And I think that's kind of...
Wait, sorry. What do you mean? The multinomial coefficient is proportional to F lambda with a simple proportionality constant?
So it's like when n is very large, then you can imagine some kind of limit where these lambdas, I guess you need to kind of rescale them appropriately.
Lambdas.
No, I think it's for any lambda.
Any lambda?
Yeah. But so, yeah. Anyway, this is just a side note. I'm sort of, I just want to kind of, you know, explore the notion of entropy. But, you know, the curious thing is that these, on both sides, these are purely combinatorial quantities, but the entropy, we think of it as sort of as continuous. And like this talk is somehow also about this tension between continuity and discreteness, as you saw on the title page. Okay, and there's another guise of entropy. It's like you can think of it as a logarithm of on probability distributions, because when you have two independent probability distributions, you know, then the joint distribution is the tensor product, and for those entropy is just a sum of entropies, and you know it's, you know, in some sense this is like a logarithm. So anyway, so these are just some examples, but there are many other different guises of entropy.
lambda?
F lambda is the dimension of the symmetric group irrep labeled by lambda.
Okay.
All right, but so for this talk, I'm interested in yet another sort of characterization of entropy, which is you can approach it axiomatically. You can just ask, so it's like you can say it's a unique function subject to some condition. And this condition is what I will call, let's talk about composing distributions. So imagine like a composed process where you sort of generate a random variable by doing two things. You first flip a coin that has n outcomes according to distribution p, and then for every outcome, there will be a separate distribution q with many other outcomes, and you kind of make a tree like this. So you flip first your n-sided coin, and then for each outcome, you do different other random kind of process. And the distribution that you get in the end, it will be just these distributions q, each of them rescaled by p. So it's like this kind of composed process. And there's a simple expression that you can verify, just from the basic definition. The entropy has this property that, of this composed distribution, the entropy is just the entropy of the first, step, which is the entropy of p, plus the convex combination of the entropies of each of these subsequent things. And this is a really nice characterization of entropy because, so entropy has this property, but actually any continuous function that obeys this property, this chain rule, is proportional to entropy. So this was shown already a long time ago by Fadeyev in 56. I think he maybe had some other assumption, it has to be symmetric or something, but this was removed by Lanster in his paper. Okay, and so the nice thing about this chain rule is that it just involves addition and multiplication. So we basically, we multiply the probabilities here, we multiply the p with h, and then we add things. So it's sort of fully, it's like algebraic. It has no logarithms, no analysis, basically. Okay, and so this is what we're going to use to cook up this entropy modulo p. Okay, so the question is, so what is this entropy modulo p? Okay, so this is going to be.
FAD 56. What paper is that?
Yeah, so this Fadeyev.
As in like the ghosts Fadeyev, or is.
It's like with two. So FADDEV. I can send you my slides afterwards.
Okay.
And also in this Lanster. So there's this paper by Tom Lanster of entropy modulo p, and that is the sort of the go-to reference. Okay, so what is the entropy modulo p? So it's a function that has n arguments. They are all they are integers modulo p, and the output is also modulo p. So like we make everything discrete, both the input and the output as well. So normal entropy has like real numbers as input and real numbers as output, but we make everything discrete. Okay, so the question is, how do we make this? And the first idea is that we need a log, right? So if we have a log, then we can take we can just use the same formula basically. So I don't know if there's some people who have seen Twin Peaks. This is the log lady. So we need the help of the log lady to cook up the log. Okay, so let's make this more formal. So we want a function, like a sort of log function, on this integers modulo p. And, how do you define a log? You can also kind of approach it axiomatically. You say, well, that's the function that's, it maps sort of the multiplication to addition, basically. It relates to these two algebraic operations. And the first thing that comes to mind if you are a quantum computer scientist is like, because Schwarz algorithm for discrete log is like, oh yeah, but we have the discrete log. Let's just use the discrete log. But the problem with the discrete log is that, so it's basically, discrete log is to what power you need to raise your integer to get one. It's basically when you're working modulo p, these powers, they have they loop around with a period p minus one because of Fermat little theorem. And so it doesn't have it doesn't have the right range, basically. So we want the output, both the input and output, be modulo p. But for the discrete log, the output is modulo p minus 1. So it's kind of like it just doesn't work. Okay. And in fact, what you can show that there is no homomorphism from the multiplicative group of integers modulo p, so the things from which it's meaningful to take log, and the integers modulo p. So basically because so it's something you can show. I think in Leinster's paper, he explains this as well. Okay, so now we need to do something else, basically. So what are we gonna do? So we're gonna look at this Fermat's little theorem. So this is just saying that for any integer, that's not divisible by p. If you raise it to the power p minus 1, then it's equal to 1 modulo p. And so in other words, this a to the p minus 1 minus 1, this is some kind of integer, and it is divisible by p. So you can just divide it by p. So this is going to, because it's divisible by p, you divide by p, you get some other integer, and then you take that modulo p. And so this whole thing together is called Fermat quotient. It's something people study in number theory. And this is basically a map from integers to integers modulo p, because, you know, in the end we take the result modulo p, so that's the answer is modulo p. Okay, this is an exercise, but if you're familiar with finite fields or whatever, just arithmetic modulo p and Fermat little theorem, you can show that this is a homomorphism. So it maps the multiplication to addition, basically. So it has this kind of log property that we wanted. But, you know, I said there was no homomorphism of the sort we wanted. And so there is a little kind of a glitch. So like with the discrete log, the glitch was in the output. Here the glitch is in the input. So basically the input turns out to be the multiplicative group of integers modulo p squared. So basically we don't have modulo p, but we have modulo p squared. But there is also a sort of a theorem which says that every homomorphism, you know, of this form is a multiple of this Fermat quotient. So basically this Fermat quotient is sort of the, for our purposes, is going to be the logarithm that we're going to use. By the way, is there any question, any point, you know, feel free to discuss. All right. So now we want to cook up this entropy modulo p. And so this is a little bit another kind of angle on it. So we, you know, okay, we have the log, but then we need also this function minus x log x. And so this function also has a special name. It's called nonlinear derivation because it has this property that if you apply it to a product of two things, you get something like this. And this is kind of looks like a derivative because it's like, you know, okay, I denoted it by this delta, but it's like, you know, you get delta A times B plus A times delta B. And if you apply it to one, you get zero. So that's a kind of a funny property, but because of this, it's called this derivation. And okay, so here let's just use this. Let's just rewrite the normal entropy, the one with that we are familiar with, using this delta. And you can write it, well, it's just, you know, it's the sum of minus x log x. So we could just write it like this. But to be able to evaluate this, so when we want to extend it to to arbitrary real numbers or even complex numbers which are not, don't form a probability distribution, they might not sum to one, I'm going to also subtract this term here. So like normally, if you have a probability distribution, this is equal to 1, and delta of 1 is equal to 0, so this doesn't matter. But when you evaluate on other things that don't sum to 1, then this term matters, and we're going to throw it in. Okay, so we can take this as the definition of the sort of the standard entropy. And you know, in number theory, there is equivalent of this derivation. It's called p derivation, and it just plays the role of minus x log x. So this Fermat quotient plays the role of log x, and this p derivation plays the role of minus x log x. And you know, we just define it like this. So it's minus x log x. So it's, you know, this was the Fermat quotient was the log, and if you write it out explicitly, you just get this formula. So you basically, you know, you can compute this integer by Fermat's little theorem, is divisible by p, you divide by p, and then you take, you know, a reminder modulo p. Okay, so that's what I just said. And then by analogy with this formula above, Leinster defined the entropy modulo p to be just this expression. So we just, you know, use the same expression, but we use this p derivation instead of this minus x log x. Okay, so that's the definition. I don't know if there's questions. Okay, so now we would like to rewrite it in some maybe a bit more insightful way, and you can write this as a polynomial. So let's say, you know, this thing is sort of like a polynomial in this input A, and you can kind of plug it in, and then if you work it out, you basically get this. So it's like you have these n inputs, and what you get is, this looks a little bit like a variance, sort of like order p or something. So you just take a sum of these guys, you take raised to power p minus, you know, sum of the p's powers, and then divide by p. So this again, magically turns out to be divisible by P, and then you take the remainder modulo P. So this is just, I just plugged in basically this Fermat quotient. Okay, so now there is a sort of like an observation, which is as follows, that it's a simple exercise to show if two integers are equal modulo P, then their P's powers are equal modulo P squared. And because we are raising stuff to the power P squared, so to the power P, you can show that, so the input, if we treat it as arbitrary integers, it kind of loops around with modulo P.
Maris, I phased out for like 10 seconds.
Yeah, sorry. Uh-huh.
So you had a definition of entropy mod P on the previous slide.
Mm-hmm.
And why now are you defining it differently?
I just wanted to rewrite it in sort of like to unwind this Fermat quotient. So the Fermat quotient is just this. Basically, I just wanted to plug it in, basically.
But if you plug that in, then you get the thing on the next slide.
Yes, you should get it because, because here you are sort of, okay, there's 1 over P in front, and then there is like the xi and minus xi to the P.
Oh, I see.
And then there is, this is basically.
I believe you. Processed it. Thanks.
Yeah, it's just, you just plug it in, and I think the sum of xi cancels out or something.
So you're assuming that the coordinates all sum to 1. Did that fly by earlier?
So actually, so here you don't need to. I think you don't need to assume that even.
Syntax or no, there's not.
Sorry, say again.
You wrote the condition there. So.
So I think I just want to define it for all x without worrying about this summing to 1. Yeah. When it sums to 1, then this kind of drops out.
I mean, what if if they're all 0? I imagine that shouldn't be defined.
Yeah, no, that's actually, it is fine, because when it's all 0, then I think it's just going to be 0 or something, but okay, so.
Intuition for what this is, I've seen some.
So here is some intuition, so what I wanted to say here is that it's, you know, maybe not totally obvious, but you can show that the input, you can treat it also as modulo P. So you can make sense of this for any integer input, but it has a period of modulo p basically, and you can show that this really is a function from integers modulo p to integers modulo p. Okay. I think I will give some alternative some intuition a bit shortly. You can, and now if you expand this, so this is you can just expand this using multinomial coefficients, and you get this explicit polynomial. So basically, this entropy mod P is just this polynomial base. And there's some cancellation that happens, the P power cancels out, and then there's some identity you need to use for the multinomial coefficient to get this minus sign. But anyways, if you do the calculation, you get this. And you can sort of, any of these expressions, you can treat it as the definition of entropy modulo P. And what Leinster shows is that, any function on integers modulo P that satisfy the chain rule is proportional to this HP. So basically, what this shows is that we did not just sort of, pull this log from the log lady and we just cook this up. It really shows that, exactly like this Fadeo's theorem, which characterizes the normal entropy, this is also like, it's a unique function. It just, it follows immediately from the chain rule, basically. All right. And because of that, I think it must be important mathematical concept, but it's just, it was discovered like, 2 years ago. So I think it's somehow surprising that it took so long. All right, so this is the story so far. So we have this first station, we have the entropy modulo P. I want to move forward. So let's discuss mutually unbiased Bayes. So I have a kind of these are the different characters in the story, and then in the end they will kind of fit together. Okay, so what are the mutually unbiased Bayes? So it's like a nice constellation of vectors in a complex space. So here's the definition. So basically, so it's just a collection of vectors in D complex dimensions. We parameterize them by two parameters A and B. So they have these inner products. Maybe, simplest way to think about this is that this index A tells you the basis, index B tells you the vector within the basis. And so what this is telling you that, for within the basis, they are orthonormal, these vectors. And, if you take two different vectors from two vectors from different bases, then you always get the same inner product. And this is, you know, this is an important concept in quantum information theory. It has all kinds of applications and so on. And yeah, so this basically is just a collection of d plus one orthonormal bases in c to the d with these particular inner products. And you know, for simplicity, you can always just rotate all these bases by applying unitary transformation to make one of them the standard base. So you really, you know, one of them is the standard base, so you really want to construct the remaining ones. That's the kind of the problem. And then it's, you know, it's easy to see if one of them is the standard base, then from this it follows that all the other vectors, what remains in all the other bases, they have the same amplitudes in all components, and you only need to figure out the phases, basically. So there's just some complex phase. And the canonical example is like in dimension two, we have three bases, and they are just like in the Bloch sphere, they look like this. So like, okay, in a Bloch sphere, all the angles are deformed by a factor of two, but the orthonormal basis means they're antipodal, and having this right inner product means they have like 90 degrees in the Bloch sphere. All right, and you know, then the question is, how do we make these things for, you know, okay, this is in dimension two, but how can we make this in other dimensions? So here's the construction. So this was by Wouters and Fields, and I guess this was maybe by Ivanovich, the first one. So basically, if you have dimension p, so this is kind of where the continuous and discrete starts to interact, because the set of mutually unbiased vectors, you know, it's just these are in continuous sort of space. But surprisingly, you need to use you know, arithmetic modulo p, so you need to use discrete finite fields. So basically, in dimension p, the way to construct it is as follows. So basically, you know, as I said, all the absolute values of the components are the same, and you just need to basically plug in this phase. So this is like a quadratic polynomial in the parameter that you're summing over, and this a and b, it just these are the coefficients in this quadratic polynomial. And when the dimension is a power of a prime, like a p to the n, and so by the way, so the p is odd. So the rest of the talk we will be dealing with the case when p is even, but when it's odd, this is the construction. And when the dimension is when it's a power of a prime, then the formula is exactly the same, except you need to, so this ax squared plus bx, it lives in the extension field, and trace is like a canonical map that maps the extension field to the base field, and so that's gives you a number modulo p. So like these, in an extension field, these are kind of more complicated objects. They are not numbers, but this maps it back to number. Then you just raise omega to that power, and that's your expression. Okay, so it's not obvious that this works. You can sort of show that this works, and you need to compute some Gauss sums and so on. But later in this talk, I will show you another way how to see why this works without computing any Gauss sums. Okay, but so this is just a summary of what's known. This is nothing new. So this is the standard construction for odd prime power dimensions. Okay, so now I want to explain. So yeah, so this talk is kind of like, I mean, there are some results, but it's more like a story basically. So now I will a little bit tell about results. So there is a very close connection between mutually unbiased bases and affine planes. And so this was actually known already by Wouters from a long time ago, but you know, sort of this relation was always sort of like, it was clear there is a relation, but it was not. What I want to show you is how to make it very precise. What exactly is the relation to the point that it is so precise that it's a matrix, it's a unitary matrix that basically relates affine planes and mutually unbiased bases. Okay, so what are we going to do? So imagine you have this grid of points, let's say 3 by 3. Like or general like p by p, and we're going to make what I will call line states. So basically, so let's just look at this case. So you have like basically, you know, two registers of that, it's like the x and y coordinate, and this just encodes all the points on the line that has coordinates x and then ax plus b. So a is the slope and b is like where this starts sort of here, and then this is the vertical line where the slope is sort of infinite. Okay, so these are our line states, and you know, if you compute the Gram matrix of these line states or the inner products between these line states, you just get this. So this is like, you know, if the lines are parallel, if they have the same slope, then the inner product between the line states is you know, either 0 or 1. So if the lines are the same, then it's 1, otherwise it's 0. The lines, they don't overlap. And, you know, if the slopes are different, then there will be exactly one point in common. So that's a property of this affine plane. And it just follows, like basically you need to solve a linear equation and, you know, in a finite field, you can invert things. That's why it works. So we are working in a finite field. Okay. So now, if you look at this, this looks very similar to inner products of the mutually unbiased bases. It looks like almost the same. And you know, And indeed, so basically, so the inner products between these line states, they are just, so in MUBS, there was like a square root here, basically. And so for these, so basically the relation is just simply the Gram matrix, so the inner products between the line states, they are the absolute value square, so the inner products between these MUB vectors. Or alternatively, you can just tensor the MUB vector with its complex conjugate, and then the inner products match up. So basically, if you double up the MUBs, then it's like the line state. And sort of like the philosophy is that so these line states, the affine plane, it's an example of a combinatorial design, and MUBs they're example of what's called a quantum design, which was introduced by Zauner. And so the philosophy is that somehow the classical design is like two quantum designs kind of stuck together, paired up in a nice way. You can also think of this is just a vectorization of the density matrix of the psi AB, by the way. It's just this vectorization of the projector on this. Okay, so this is one of the small results in this talk. So we were wondering during the pandemic with Harry Berman, you know, okay, so that we have this relation. I mean, there's a long story actually. There's a funny story how we came to this question, but we were just wondering. So like, you know, if the Gram matrices of these sets of vectors are the same, there must be an isometry, and you know, what is that isometry? Like, you know, can we write down a quantum circuit for this? And it turns out it's very simple. So basically, this has, you know, two qubits. And you basically apply Fourier transform, and then you apply this P operation. So what is the P operation? So this is just a permutation. So for any standard basis vector, so x and y are in a finite field, you know, whatever, of some prime power size, it acts like this. You compute x plus y divided by 2 and x minus y divided by 2. And like, you know, as John told me yesterday, so this is like it's sort of like a Hadamard matrix that we used in quantum computing, but it's like a kind of a finite field version one. So you can also think of this as sort of like a beam splitter that kind of mixes the two modes together in some interesting way. And it's obvious also that this is, yeah?
Sorry, do you mind going back to the previous slide for a second where you define the L and okay. And then also the psi, these are the states, and then the L, these are
the line states. Yeah. So these line states, they are, you know, their amplitudes are just zeros and one, and then it's normalized by 1/√2. So they are kind of like they encode combinatorial information. They just encode which points are on which lines. So they don't have any phases.
Interesting, just because there's another configuration that seems relevant that's related to this picture of this affine plane over F3 that I was familiar with. It's like some like lines in C3. Is this the same thing? Is L here, or is this a different configuration of vectors?
Equiangular lines.
Very same picture. You can get like nine.
Yes. Right. Yes. I'm not talking about this in this talk, but there is also a sense. So there's you can consider the dual of the affine plane, where you exchange the notion of points and lines. And you can define point states, which are saying, you know, the point state is basically a superposition of all the lines that goes through the point. And then the inner products between these point states will be pairwise the same. And so this is similar to the SIGPOEM, the so-called equiangular lines in a complex space. And so basically the dual of the affine plane in a very similar way as what I was saying here, there is a similar unitary transformation that maps the dual of the affine plane to the SIGPOEMs, also a pair of SIGPOEM vectors. But you know, I'm not going to talk about this in this talk, but this is something also that we observed with Harry.
Oh, interesting. Thanks.
All right. And by the way, you know, there are no new insights in this talk in the sense that, I mean, you know, this is about relating things that we already know. We know affine planes, modulo, you know, from finite fields. We know how to make MUBs from finite fields. And we're just saying they are related, basically. But you know, it doesn't let us find new MUBs or new affine planes. Just to
clarify, so P is diagonal in the computational basis.
So no, it's not diagonal. It is a permutation matrix. So it maps, so these X and Y are standard basis vectors.
Permutation matrix, okay. So the X plus Y should not be interpreted as a superposition of X plus Y.
No. So this is infinite field. So you compute this infinite field and you multiply by the inverse of the element two. Yeah. So these are elements of the finite field. You perform this computation in the finite field. Right, and so anyway, this was something we observed, and we thought, oh yeah, this is very elegant, very nice, very simple relationship. But there's the divided by two. So like, for qubits, it doesn't work. Basically, you cannot divide by two because two is not invertible. And so this whole talk that I'm talking about, it just came from the, okay, I thought like, okay, we have infinitely many cases, we should just do the qubit case and then we're done. Yeah.
Can I add another very speculative question that goes beyond my realm of knowledge? I think that the same thing arises in the study of the Clifford hierarchy, where you have to divide by two, and so then it's...
Oh, I don't know. We can talk about it afterwards. Yeah, I
feel like it's a very different...
During some calculation that you alluded to for like showing that those mobs,
yes,
the field trace are mobs.
Yes.
During having to do like completing the square. And when you end up having to like pull out a factor of two, and that's what kind of messes everything up for characters too.
I see. By the way, who is speaking? Okay. All right, thanks. Yes. And actually, like in this calculation, like if you want to show that this works, you also will have to complete a square. There will be some kind of square completing that. All right, let me move on. So now, I want to know, like, can we do this for the powers of two? Because, this basically doesn't work. And okay, so there is a construction. So this is the canonical construction for the prime powers when P is odd. And in dimension two to the n for qubits, you have this formula. So what is this formula? So it looks kind of similar, this kind of trace and stuff. So what are all these elements? So first of all, these bold symbols, they are not in a finite field. They're what's called Galois ring. So here, this is basically a ring of polynomials with coefficients modulo 4, and they're polynomials of degree n. Okay, so this is these bold symbols are those. And this Tn is a special set. It's called Teichmuller set. So I will explain later what these things are. I just want to kind of introduce them. And so anyway, that's a special set. It's a subset of this Galois ring, subset of these polynomials. And it has a property when you take it entry-wise modulo 2, you get precisely every finite field element once. So these polynomials are modulo 4, but when you take the modulo 2, you get the elements in finite field. You get all the polynomials exactly once. And this trace map is sort of, it's like a trace map in the Galois ring. So I will explain later how to compute this. And so basically, this talk is about trying to understand what the heck this means. Like, how do I do this? Like, finite field is something I'm comfortable with, but these Galois rings and Teichmuller sets and all that, I don't really understand. And I wanted to kind of replace this formula with just a formula in a finite field of 2 to the n elements, just like it's here, basically. So I thought, like, okay, I don't really understand this. I want to just have it over the finite field because, like, this is over finite field. Why can't I have it? This is over finite field. So I was just trying to derive basically a formula for. Okay, so what do we have so far? So I introduced entropy modulo P, the mutual unbiased bases. Okay, so now so what we're going to do? We need to have some abstract algebra. So I want to talk a little bit about the Galois fields and rings. So like basically, what is that? And so that we understand like these concepts that I introduced here. Okay, so here's a very quick algebra refresher. So, let's say you have some polynomial, which is monic, so it has no coefficient at the highest power. It's just basically, it's a linear combination of these monomials. And, okay, so what does it mean to work modulo a polynomial? It just means we treat this polynomial as being equal to zero, which is the same as just saying the z to the n, if this is equal to zero, is equal to minus, the rest, basically. And we can use this to reduce, if we have a polynomial, we can reduce its power, the highest degree always to be smaller than n by just repeatedly applying this identity. Like, so for example, let's say if, you have the z squared equals z plus 1, that's your identity here. Then if you have like z to the 5, you can just, smash it many times with this identity and eventually you get some polynomial where the powers are less than 2. Okay, so it just lets you basically bring the maximal degree below n. And the notation is that, you know, we have the variable z, we have the coefficients that are integers, and we're going to write this, meaning that we're going to work modulo this this polynomial f. Okay, so then, you know, how do you make these finite fields of degree n? You can think of them as, so that you can basically define them as follows. You can say that they are just polynomials with coefficients in the base field, and you treat them as modulo some special polynomial, which is, you know, has some properties. It's monic and irreducible, but, you know, it doesn't matter. It's just some special polynomial. And the Galois ring is similar. So here if you can also, so this is like the z, so integers modulo p to the k, they form a ring, so it's not a field, but it's a ring. And you can extend it to this Galois ring. And the way you do this is you basically, again, you make polynomials with coefficients in this ring now, not in a field, but in a ring. And you take in modulo some special polynomial, which is basic primitive, has some special properties. Okay, and so these Galois rings, they kind of generalize both rings as well as finite fields.
What does that arrow mean? Like when you say Galois field FP?
Oh yeah, so this is how we construct the extension.
FP, and then you get a Galois.
Yeah. FP. Yes. Yeah. So like how can we extend basically these fields or the rings? Right, and so this Galois ring has two parameters. It has the n, that's the degree of the polynomial, and a k, which is the base ring basically. And so, you know, so if both of these parameters are equal to 1, then this is just integers modulo p, which is also a finite field of size p. If you keep this k equal to 1, so then this is just zp, so then this is just a finite field, so you don't have any ring. So basically you are kind of in this first row, and you just have this you know, the normal finite fields that we all know. But as you keep increasing this k, this other parameter, it increases the degree of this base ring. And you basically you can go from the integers modulo p to integers modulo p to the k. So this is not a field, but it's a ring. And, you know, if you go the other way now, if you kind of extend it, then you end up here. Or similarly, you can think of you can have these two knobs and you can kind of turn them around basically.
So what's a basic primitive polynomial?
Yeah, it has some properties. I don't want to go into this. It's sort of like the natural notion of this irreducible polynomial.
Wikipedia just says you need it to be monic with its irreducible mod p. Would that be irreducible mod p?
Yeah, I don't remember. I think they said it. Maybe it was something about the roots or something. I don't remember. Yeah, I basically just treat it as a black box. It's some kind of, you know, polynomial that has magic properties and it makes it work. And to be honest, I want to get rid of this. I hate these Galois rings. I don't understand them. You know, I just want to, you know, just forget about them. I just want to use this basically. That's the whole point. Okay. Right. So let's just look at some examples. So, you know, so for example, if we have the ring of 2 elements, we want to make a field of 2 elements. We want to make a field of 4 elements. We can use this polynomial. We can work modulo this z squared plus z plus 1. And, you know, then this field of 4 elements is just going to be these linear polynomials with coefficients modulo 2. And when we multiply, then we operate subject to z squared equals z plus 1, which is this identity modulo 2. So minus 1 is equal to plus 1. Okay, so if we want to make a ring extension, so here's an example. So, you know, let's say you have the polynomials with coefficients modulo 4. This same polynomial turns out to be also this basic whatever monic polynomial, and so you can just look at this. This is going to be your Galois ring of with coefficients modulo 4 and degree at most 2, and it will consist of these all the constant polynomials and all the linear polynomials with both coefficients being modulo 4, and here the operation, the multiplication, is basically subject to this, which is the modulo 4 version of this being equal to 0. Okay, and so another thing you can see is that if you work modulo 2 instead of modulo 4, then this is going to turn into the finite field of 4 elements. And more generally, it is the case that when you take this Galois ring, and if you reduce all the coefficients modulo p, it will turn into the finite field. Basically, there is a sense in which there is a finite field is sitting inside this Galois ring. All right. So so that's sort of, I hope that gives you some idea what these Galois rings are. So then there are other concepts. There was one concept which is necessary is what's called Teichmuller set and also Teichmuller lift. Okay, so the Teichmuller set is simply it's the number 0, 1, and then the variable z, and all the powers of your z up to the p to the n minus 2. So you can see that there are p to the n elements in this Teichmuller set. And you can show that if you take this Teichmuller set modulo p, you will get every element of the finite field exactly once. So basically, if you reduce all these, so they have very high degree, but if you reduce them modulo p, then you will get the finite field. So in some sense, this is kind of like this, the finite field is sitting inside this Teichmuller set. It's kind of lifted into this object. And okay, so it's obvious that this set is closed under multiplication, but it is not closed under addition. So basically, you lift your finite field and you put it in this Teichmuller set, and that preserves multiplication, but it screws up the addition. So this Teichmuller set, therefore, it's just a set. It's not a ring or anything like that. And the what's called Teichmuller lift is just the operation that it's the inverse of reducing modulo p. So instead of taking some polynomial with coefficients modulo p to the k, you can reduce the modulo p and you can go backwards basically, and that the inverse of that is called Teichmuller lift. So let me just give you an example. So I showed you this example of the finite. So the Teichmuller set for this Galois ring of modulo 4 and degree 2 is just this. You just go to 0, 1, z, and z square, and then it becomes this if you reduce modulo this. And so what you can easily see is if you take these four elements that form the Teichmuller set, if you reduce them modulo 2, you get this. You get every element of the finite field exactly once. This is the finite field modulo 4. And the inverse operation, this is what I call this Teichmuller lift. It lifts the field and puts it into the ring, basically. Yeah, sorry, this talk is sort of, some of the things are kind of technical. All right. Now, so we need to understand. So in this MOB formula, there was a trace. So we need to understand what the hell is this trace. So there's this trace here. This is a trace in the Galois ring. So unfortunately, I have to explain what that is. Understand what the formula is saying. Okay. So here's the thing. So basically, you can show that any element of the Galois ring, you can express it as a linear combination of these elements from this Teichmuller set. And this expression is unique. It's called p-adic representation. It's just basically you take these elements from this set and you put them together with these different powers of p. And you can show that there is a unique decomposition like this. And then you can define Frobenius automorphism. So this is a similar concept that exists in finite fields by just you first compute this expansion and it's unique. And then you raise every t to the power p. So you just basically just replace every ti by ti to the power p. So let's just have an example. So in our this our friend ring this one, according to what I said before, there's a unique any element has unique decomposition of being a plus 2 times b. So the prime is just 2, and so you can also see that sort of like that it work that it is unique by if you take A to be elements from this Teichmuller set and B to be elements from the Teichmuller set. If you compute A plus 2B, you can see here in this table, you get every element once. So basically every element from this ring you get once. And then in this case, this Frobenius automorphism is just defined that you first, you find this decomposition and then you take the A and B and you square them. So that's, the P is 2 in this case. So that's the definition of this Frobenius automorphism. And then using that, we can define the trace in this ring. Okay, so how do you define, how do you think about this trace? So you can think of this ring also as a vector space over this ring with integers modulo p to the k. And the basis are just these monomials in this variable z. And the multiplication, so if you want to define multiplication, then it's just if you want to multiply by z, you just go through all these powers of this element z, and the last power z to the n is equal to this because that's you work modulo this polynomial. And so basically the multiplication by this variable z, this is symbolic variable, it just corresponds to multiplication by this matrix. So basically, in this linear space spanned by these n elements here, you know, you can think of multiplication by z as a matrix. So basically, you can, instead of thinking of this as polynomials, modulo some other polynomial, you can think of this as a set of matrices over the Bayes ring, and you know, it's a special subset of matrices, and you just, you know, and you just replace this element z with this matrix. And so if you want to define trace, well, what is a trace? It's just a trace of this matrix. So basically, you know, if you have any polynomial, it has you know, you just write it as a polynomial, and the trace is going to be a linear map. So you just, you know, you can pull out these coefficients. You just need to compute a trace of the zi, and we replace the zi by this matrix to the power I, and that's just the matrix over the Bayes ring, and we can take a trace. Basically, this is how you can think intuitively about what does it mean to compute a trace in the finite field or in this ring. Okay, but so okay, but there's another definition which is not obvious why this is correct and equivalent, which is as follows. So this is like, okay, so if you are familiar with finite field, this is something you have seen before. So basically, in a finite field, you can use the same story that I said before. You can represent you know, this variable x by a matrix. And then if you want to take a trace, you just take a trace of that matrix. But what you can also show that is equal to this, that you can just kind of, you know, you can stay within the land of the polynomials, and you can compute this trace in terms of, instead of matrices, you can think of the field as being polynomials, and you can compute it directly in terms of polynomials. Okay, so by definition, this trace is linear because you define it as a trace of matrix, even though this is not obvious why this should be linear. And then the Galois trace, you can define it for the Galois ring, you can, you know, define it algebraically in the same way. And instead of raising x to the power p to the I, you apply I times this Frobenius automorphism. So for finite fields, the raising x to the power p, this is called Frobenius automorphism. And for the Galois rings, there was a more complicated definition of the Frobenius automorphism, but you just do that, and you do this operation I times, and then you sum everything together, and that's the trace in the ring. Yes. All right. Okay. So now, so let's go back to the construction of the MUBs. So basically, you know, so now we have all the ingredients. So, you know, we have this Galois ring. So let's say we look at the MUBs on 2 qubits, n is equal to 2. So we can use this ring. Then the Teichmuller set was just 0, 1, and all the powers of z. We reduce the modulo of this polynomial, we get this. You need to compute a trace of this variable z. You can replace by matrix and compute a trace is equal to 3. And then you have all the ingredients. You can just plug this into the formula, and then you get these MUBs. So basically, there's a standard basis, and all the other MUBs are the columns of these matrices. And you know, you get some powers of I. So basically, all the entries are 1, plus minus 1, and plus minus I. So that's kind of the concrete instantiation of this kind of this formula. Okay, so what's the story so far? So we saw the entropy modulo P, we saw the Galois rings, and they are used to construct mutually unbiased bases for qubits, which are important quantum information. And now I want to connect all these things to the entropy modulo P. So basically, so I will explain now this concept of Witt vectors. And sorry for the barrage of algebraic sort of concepts. Yep.
Can I ask a quick question before you go on to the next thing?
Yes, sure.
Like, what Teichmuller, like, how much smaller is it than the Galois ring that it lives inside? Like, half the size or something?
Sorry, say it again. How big is this Teichmuller set?
So you said the Teichmuller set, like, it's like a subset of the Galois ring, right?
Yes. Yeah, so it has p to the n elements, so maybe if I go back, so yeah, so this Galois ring, it has like okay, so this set has p to the n elements by definition, and the ring itself has like p to the k to the n elements.
P to the k.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because it's all polynomials with coefficients in the Bayes.
And yep, completely different happen if you like try to carry out this construction using the Galois for like p.
Yeah. So that's a good question. Yeah, I don't really. Yeah, like it seems strange that we need to do this special thing for the qubits, and I don't know. Like, yeah, I don't know if there is a nice way to phrase both things in a unified way. It's in some sense, yeah, it's kind of something. Yeah, that's something I would like to understand.
Because I'm also just wondering where, like, in your formula for like the for this, yeah, this
yeah, exactly
of that, like why that multiplicity of four.
I know. You would expect here to be the square root of minus. You would expect to be plus minus, like minus one here. Yeah, yeah, that's what you have. Yeah, yeah, but you kind of have to take an extra square root. I mean, I think, yeah.
So, like, how this is?
Like, yeah, all these. I think you need. Yeah, you need to ask some number theorists. I think they probably have some good answer to this, but I don't have a good answer. All right. Let me move on. Okay. So you know. So basically. Okay. Now we at least understand what this formula means, but I still don't like that it has the Galois rings and Teichmuller set and all that. I want to get rid of all that. I want to have just finite field of size 2 to the n. Express it in terms of. That. And this requires a new concept called the width vectors. Okay. So what are the width vectors? So they are used in. In number theory, and anyway, you know, this is something I learned on my own. I'm not an expert on this at all. So basically, the way it works, so they consider width vectors with infinitely many components, but we need just what's called truncated width vectors that have two components. So basically, let's say we have a commutative ring R, and we just look at pairs of elements from the ring, and we're going to call it the width vector. So it's just like it's just a vector of two components of the element of the ring. And they have this kind of crazy terminology. The p-typical ghost components of a width vector are given as follows. So the first component, or sort of the zeros component, is just the zeros component, is just x0. And this next component is given by this. It's basically you just take these x0 and x1, and instead of saying the second component is like x1, you compute this. And I don't have a good intuition why they're doing this. And they have like a generalization of this where you just, if you have more components, you just keep going. But anyway, we just take this as a definition. So this is the definition of the two components of the width vector. And you know what you can do is you can try to turn these width vectors, or basically this pair, the kind of two copies of the ring, you can try to turn it into ring itself. So you can basically say, you know, we would like that these components to be basically homomorphisms under addition. So we're going to define addition of two elements, so basically of two pairs, and we want this to be homomorphism, and we want this to be homomorphism. So we basically want to force a ring structure onto the two copies of R, and the trivial way to do this would be just pairwise, multiply, like entry-wise, multiply and add. But these width vectors, they force a non-trivial kind of a ring structure, like a different ring structure as in the trivial. Okay, and so basically, and it turns out that you can do this, and this will implicitly define addition and multiplication into this pair of elements, and you can write out explicitly what is the formula for this. And if you do this, now we come back to the entropy modulo p. So this is how the kind of things tie together. So basically, if you use this, you just take this as a definition. So this should be homomorphism and this should be homomorphism for addition and multiplication. It forces you the addition operation. It forces to become this. You get an explicit formula. And it just becomes you add the first component and the second component you also add, and then you subtract entropy modulo p of x0 and y0. Like it basically somehow enters the picture, this entropy modulo p. So like basically this arithmetic of these width vectors, it kind of naturally contains this entropy modulo p sitting inside it. And the multiplication, it becomes this. So there are no entropy modulo p, but this is what comes out. And let me just remind you, so this explicit formula for this entropy modulo p, when you have only two arguments, it just becomes this. You can write it. It's just like it's basically a polynomial with these coefficients. And by Fermat's theorem, the division by p always makes sense. And you can show that the additive and multiplicative identity are given by these two guys. I think this is very interesting because these width vectors, they give you all kinds of nice properties of this entropy modulo p that just come out of this being a ring. So now if you want to check that this is a ring, you need to check, for example, the associativity of addition. And it means, if you do this operation, on three things, that you can put the brackets any way you want. And what comes out is this equation. And this basically what this says is, this is in algebra, abstract algebra, this is known as co-cycle condition. So it's kind of, anyway, you just combine these three elements, A, B, C, in two different ways. and you get an identity, and people call this a call cycle. And I think this sort of the cool thing about this is that, you know, this is yet another kind of glimpse of entropy. It's saying that this entropy is a call cycle. And so there are people from, like, you know, from category theory and abstract algebra, they study this kind of perspective. They look at generalizations of entropy where they say that, you know, that they think of entropy as being a call cycle. But anyway, I'm not an expert. I just wanted to point out, I think it's kind of a cool thing. And it just comes out from this identity comes out from the associativity of addition. And you can also check, for example, that multiplication disputes over addition, and that gives you yet another property of this entropy modulo p. You get this identity that if you have a constant, you can pull it out and it raises to the power p. All right, so now let me explain the relation to the Galois rings of these wit vectors. So, you know, my sort of the whole story is I want to get rid of these Galois rings, and I want to replace them by finite fields. And the wit vector is just going to, that's what it's going to be. Okay, so we're going to be interested only in a case when k is equal to 2. And, you know, now if you go back to all the crazy stuff I introduced. Okay, so we have this p-adic decomposition. So any element in this ring can be expressed in this form, where the t0 and t1 are in this Teichmuller set. And there was, remember, this Teichmuller lift. This was the inverse operation of taking things modulo p. It lifts your field into the ring. Okay, so basically, it establishes a correspondence between pairs of elements in the field, which is what I like, and an element in the Galois ring, which is I don't like. I hate the Galois rings. Okay, and what you can show is that this Galois ring, when the base ring is modulo p square, that is just equivalent to this ring of Witt vectors of two elements, where each element is in the finite field p to the n. So basically, you know, I can forget about these guys. I don't like them. I can just think of, you know, I'm just operating on pairs of elements on a finite field, and I have this funny addition and multiplication operation. But this is all entirely in terms of the finite field, and I don't have to think about the ring anymore. Okay, and there is an explicit isomorphism, so it's sort of like I really wanted to know what it is, and somehow people just say, oh, this isomorphic, but I was lucky to find a formula. So there's a paper that says, you know, given two elements of your finite field, this is how you can lift it using this Teichmuller lift to the ring, and there's the inverse formula given element from the ring, you can go backwards. Anyway, there's a one-to-one correspondence, and it's you can always just go back and forth. So if you don't like the ring, you can just work with the Witt vectors. Okay, so now...
Is this quadratic case?
Say it again?
Does that only work for...
No, this works in also for higher k, okay. But I basically, for the mobs, I don't need it, so I kind of don't care about it. Okay, now we can transfer all the elements, like this Frobenius and the trace, from the rings to these Witt vectors. So that we can, you know, get rid of the rings. And so, okay, so what is the Frobenius map? It's, anyway, by the definition, it was basically raising the two entries of the Witt vector to the power of p. This what happens if you use this isomorphism between the ring and these Witt vectors. And then, yeah, this becomes a ring homomorphism, and that's, you know, it's compatible with addition and multiplication. And again, like these Witt vectors are just, it's like a great source of identities for or properties of this entropy modulo p. So for example, if you want to check that this is really true, you will get this property for the entropy. So basically, you know, if you compute entropy of some elements, you know, A, and then raise to power p, it's the same as pulling the p inside, basically. All right. So then you can use this Frobenius to define a trace, and you just get this, and that's straightforward. That's by definition, basically. And here the funny thing is that this addition, the sum here, is this funny sum. We are working with Witt vectors, and they have this funny addition operation where first component we just add, but in the second component we use this entropy modulo p when we're adding. And you know, in particular, you know, when yeah, so the formula becomes like this. So if you write this out explicitly, then you get like this, that you, so these are two elements of the finite field. If you want to take the trace of this, you take the trace of the first element. And for the second one, you take the trace of this minus this HP function. And so this function I don't understand. So it just kind of popped out here when you define a trace. And okay, what it is, it's basically, it's a one argument function. and it computes the entropy of what's called the Frobenius orbit of this element. So you basically take this element and you raise it to all the powers of p, and then you compute the entropy, and that's this function. And I don't know, like I think there must be some kind of interpretation of this function in like Shannon theory, or like, I mean, it's not binary entropy function, it has one argument, but anyway, I don't know what this function means, but I think it should have some kind of interpretation. Okay, and you know, then you can check that the trace is linear, and this again it gives you some nice identities for the entropy modulo p. Okay, so this was a big story, all kinds of crazy characters introduced. So now we can put everything together. So let's just go back to the MUBS. So this is like the original question that I had is like, I don't understand the construction of MUBS in a qubit case. I want to just get rid of all the rings, and I want to replace it by a finite field. Okay, so if you remember the formula for the MUBS, it has this expression where this is, you know, everything is in a Galois ring. We have the trace, and we have all these guys, which I don't like. So we can, you know, this Galois ring was isomorphic to the Witt vectors of, you know, two elements from the finite field. And the isomorphism just says that, you know, you take this A and B, and you take it modulo P, and then you have to raise this guy to the square. And for the X, you don't have to do anything. So anyway, you basically get this. So we just transform it across on the other side. And now this is everything is in a finite field. So, you know, we know how to multiply the Witt vectors. We have the formula. We just apply it. If you want to take the trace, we have the formula for the trace. We get this. There's a mystery entropy function that appears there. And then, you know, if we really want to go back, we can also just use the isomorphism and go backwards. So basically, you know, if you don't like these Witt vectors like I do, you can always, go to if you don't like the Galois ring, you can always just go on this side, do your calculations. Here I have simple explicit formulas, and then you go back. And this has the property that it introduces this entropy modulo P. And in particular, in the case when P is equal to 2, which is what we care for the MUBS, this H2 function, it's basically this. It's kind of like it's the sum of all powers of X, where the power has two digits, one in a binary expansion. So that this is kind of some kind of magic entropy function that appears. Okay, so now we can take this formula that is in terms of the Galois rings. We can just say, you know, forget about the rings. Here's a formula just in terms of the finite fields. So basically, you know, we want to construct MUBS. They are labeled by these A and B. Instead of them being in the Teichmuller set, blah, 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 we just take them to be in a finite field. And we, you know, we use this explicit formula. So we can compute the trace in a finite field. That's the power of I. And for the power of minus one, we compute this. And the only thing we need to compute is this entropy modulo 2, but it's just this polynomial, so that's easy to compute.
Is that a stabilizer state?
I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah.
You just need to check if that thing is a linear function, right? And if
yes, yeah, yeah. I think it probably is, but yeah, I don't know. But I'm going over time, so I should wrap it up. Okay, and so like for the comparison, so this is the formula for the odd prime power dimensions, and this is for the even one. So at least, you know, okay, they don't look the same, they still look different. I don't know if there's a way to reconcile them, but at least what I got rid of the rings, I just have everything in terms of the field. And you can also, so remember there was this story about the relationship between MUBs. If you have two MUB vectors, it's like one line vector. So there's like a relationship between the discrete designs and the quantum designs. And in dimension 2 to the n, there is a similarly elegant quantum circuit that's going to give you the correspondence. So this took me a really long time to find. But basically, you know, time goes from right to left. That's how we should be doing this in quantum computing. So if you start with line state, you apply Fourier transform, then you apply some conditional operation, where you have this H matrix, which is diagonal matrix, has this entropy on sitting on a diagonal. And then this is like, this is a squaring operation in a finite field. This is a Fourier transform. And then you do some addition and multiplication in a finite field, and then you apply the square root of swap inverted. And then that gives you this. So this is like an explicit formula that relates to these line states and the MUBS. And because each of these steps is unitary, this proves that these are MUBS without you having to compute the Gauss sums. So normally, if you look at the explicit formulas for these, you want to check that these are MUBS, you need to prove the Gauss sums. But here, you just need to see that this is unitary and this is obvious, and here it's more or less obvious as well. And that automatically shows that these guys have the right inner product because their inner products are the same as these. Okay, so summary. So we have all these characters. So we had the vit vectors. So these are just vectors with two components where both components are in a finite field. And they have the funny addition property, the funny addition formula, which explicitly features the entropy modulo 2. And the trace also features the mystery entropy function. Then we have the Galois rings, which you know are kind of more complicated objects, but they are isomorphic to these vit vectors with two components. And you can just, you can compute the trace in a Galois ring just in terms of the trace in a finite field. And then we have a formula for mutual unbiased bases that features only the finite field elements and there are no more Galois rings. So that's it. So then there are many open questions. So, can we unify the odd and even cases? I don't know. What is the meaning of this mystery function that appears in this mob formula? I don't know that either. Then you can, of course, go crazy. You can say, we have entropy modulo 2. What about quantum entropy, entropy modulo P? What about quantum entropy modulo P? This is, I think, also a nice question to look at. Then these vit vectors and their arithmetic were really a great source of all kinds of properties of this identities for this entropy modulo P. But I was using only vit vectors with two components, but normally number theorists use vit vectors with infinitely many components. So there must be infinitely many entropy identities that you might get. And maybe you also get some other kind of notions of entropy that you can get modulo P. Obvious question if you are an information tree person is what is the operational interpretation of entropy modulo P? As I said, it's normal entropies has interpretation as the rate of coding. And is there some kind of a discrete coding problem you can set up where this has this interpretation? I think that's a really very, very nice question. And you can also ask, does it have a combinatorial interpretation? So in the beginning, I said the entropy has this interpretation as the multinomial coefficient or the dimension of the EREP. And maybe this one also has interpretation like that. Of course, you can you can build a whole information theory modulo P. You can define mutual information, conditional and relative entropy, and blah, blah, blah. I think that's also something one can investigate. And so for these mobs, the relationships I showed you, it just relates known objects. It relates mobs that we know how to construct and affine planes that we know how to construct. But there are also some funny affine planes that are called non-Desargesian, which are smallest example is dimension 9. And in that case, these affine planes don't use finite fields. They use some kind of more complicated algebraic structures. And it would be interesting to kind of generalize this to also do these other affine planes. And of course, there's the philosophical question of does the entropy modulo P have some deeper meaning in physics? Because, I was trying to make kind of this argument saying, it's kind of connected to quantum information in some sense. I don't know. That's a nice question. It maybe has a connection or maybe it has not the question. So that's the end of my talk. Maybe it's... All right, sorry for going over time.
If there are burning questions, we could have it now. Otherwise, we could just discuss downstairs. We had a lot of questions during the talk. Right. Are there any? All right, let's thank Maris again.